Hi, everyone. It's a small crowd. You guys can come down. Way up in the back. So, I'm here to talk about how to have an open relationship with software. So, does anyone, who here knows what, like, free software means? Open source? One person? Only one? A couple of you know. What's that? Nobody really knows what it means. Yeah, right. Well, this guy says it's, you know, it's free software, obviously not good for your health. Free software means it's free to use, free to learn, free to change, and free to share. That's why I like to remember it. It's not about, like, free as in cost, right? They say free as in beer. It's about free as in liberty. As in, you can use it, you can change it, you can give it to your friends. No one's going to hold you down to that long EULA, right? Nobody reads that thing anyway. So that's free software. And this came about, you know, as a time when, in the beginning, all software was free. And then companies started making money off of software. And so the people came along and they decided that we needed to formalize free software. And how do we define what that is? And they started this thing called the Free Software Foundation, right? Free software is software that gives you, the user, the freedom to share, study, and modify it. We call this free software because the user is free. Right. And, you know, that's all good, and that's good that they made this thing happen, but at the end of the day, like, I don't know if it matters a lot to the average business person who's not a developer. Maybe it does. So I think a lot of people, the first question they have when they hear the word free is, well, how do I make any money off this software, right? If it's free, I can't really sell it, and then I develop it, and then someone else can take it and put a new name on it and sell it as their thing, and then I don't make anything, right? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. But there's a lot of companies that have made a really good living off of free software. These are some of them. You guys are probably familiar with most of them. And these are companies which are specifically based around open source or free software. So, for instance, people have heard of Red Hat, I assume. It's like the most famous one. And so they make their money off of which software? Anyone know? What software do they make their money off of? What's that? Linux, yeah. Or more specifically, GNU Linux, whatever, which is the operating system that, you know. So they support that operating system, and they contribute to it, and they provide services around it. They don't sell the operating system. They sell services around it. So people, they sell training, they sell consulting to help people integrate it. These companies are all kind of doing the similar thing. Acquia is like that for Drupal, right? Acquia doesn't sell Drupal, but Acquia sells services around Drupal to make it easier to use. You know, there's a lot of other companies, too, which are not open source companies, per se. This list right here is actually, this is the contributors to the Linux kernel. So these are the top 20 companies who have contributed, and the number of changes. Red Hat's number one. That's an open source company. Novell, not really. Sort of open source company, right? IBM, they support a lot of open source. They're certainly not an open source company, per se, though. They sell a lot of proprietary, expensive software and hardware. Intel, far from it, right? And if you look down the list, right, there's not, like, you have people like, you know, Fujitsu, right, Nokia. You know, these are not Oracle, please. These are not people who, you know, are altruistic in any way. They're large corporations trying to make lots of money. And I guess the point I'm trying to make here is it's not about altruism. It's not about, like, this movement of giving back a gift economy. It started that, but for them it's strategic. It makes sense to do it. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about why is it strategic and how is it strategic. But first I'm going to start with my relationship with Drupal and how I got involved in Drupal and become part of free software. 2006, that's me. You like it? Yeah. I had that haircut for like 6 hours, but whatever. It's so I hated Drupal. I've been doing web development since I was like, you know, 16 years old or whatever, which is like 4 years now, something like that, I think. And so I've been developing for about, I don't know, eight years at this time, and I wanted to get out of technology, and I looked on Craigslist in the nonprofit section, and I found this company called Civic Actions. You guys heard of Civic Actions? A few of you heard of Civic Actions? And so that was when Drupal was pretty young, and they did Drupal websites for nonprofits. So I said, that's a kind of a good mix of what I do and what I want to do. So let's do that. And I just hated it. I mean, it had all these anti-patterns in it. Like, from a software development perspective, it was terrible. This bad documentation. People were jerks, like these really angry nerds in IRC when you ask for help. You know, and like, it was a total turnoff. I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't want to become part of the community. I did mostly like CiviCRM integration work and stuff like that for about a year. Didn't get involved. I used the software. I downloaded it and used it, but I didn't contribute actively in any way. And then something changed for me after a while of being involved in it. I got used to the people in IRC. I got used to the way they talk. And, you know, I was fortunate that my handle is my name. It's Jacob Singh. And there's another Jacob in the community, Jacob Redding. And back in the day, the community was small. And so there's autocomplete in IRC. So people would try to talk to him, and they'd end up talking to me. So I ended up making friends that way. I got involved and I spec'd out a project for Amnesty International to do amnesty.org, which is their main website, and we won that bid, and then I was offered the lead, so I led the project, and it was probably the biggest Drupal project that year, and you know, we had a team of like 10 people working on it, a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, you know, and it was a good project, but doing something like that obviously required me to get really involved in Drupal core and contributed modules, especially IE10N. We did the site in Arabic. It's like one of the first big sites that did multi-languages right to left. So part of that was like I couldn't succeed at that goal without really getting involved in the community. And it taught me sort of how that works and the value of giving back in the gift economy. And then, you know, after that, I quit that. It's kind of stressful being project manager and you know, programmer in that context. Quit it for a while, and I decided to build my own thing. Like Amnesty did a lot of stuff with search, with the Google search appliance. People heard of that before? It's like a enterprise search thing. And I thought this would be cool to give to the little guys. So I built a service that would host Apache Solr, which, you know, at the time, it's like it was a sort of a fledgling experimental project. And I did that with Robert Douglas. And I built out this service. And then Acquia said, we want to do the same thing. So they said, why don't you come do it for us instead? I said, how much are you going to pay me? And they said, well, that's good. And then I joined them. And that was 3 years ago. And then I did Drupal Gardens. So I spent 2 years building Drupal Gardens, being part of that team. That's like product development. We're contributing everything we do to core. We're building out this service for people to host Drupal on their own. Some people in my training class, I see you guys use Drupal Gardens, so you saw how bad it was. That was my fault. And we built Drupal Gardens, and that was my next thing. And that's actually a good segue. Acquia, I have to do with the obligatory corporate plug. So you guys know who Acquia is, right? Most of you. It was founded by the founder of Drupal, Dries. And we do a lot of services around Drupal, and we're hiring. And I get a healthy commission if any of you want to join. So kick back. You know, get in touch. And so, yeah, anyway, now, the past, like, 6 months, my role has changed again, and now I'm doing mostly training and sort of strategic planning with organizations, which is a fancy way of saying you go in, you charge a huge hourly rate, and you give them advice, but you're not actually on the hook to deliver a site, which is awesome. If you can get those kind of projects, I highly recommend it, you know. And so that's kind of what I do now. But mainly I like to do training, and so that's sort of point of all this is, you know, I've kind of done everything when it comes to Drupal and businesses. So everything from selling it to marketing it to managing teams, training, product development, Scrum, all that stuff. And along the way, through it all, I changed a lot. And I met a lot of people who taught me about contributing in open source projects and communities. And so I asked all of them before doing this presentation about, like, what are the things that work for you? What are the things that make this an effective relationship? Be part of this. And so I'm going to start where the money is with the salespeople. Is anyone here a salesperson? One? Two? Sort of. No one wants to admit it. They do it, but they don't want to call themselves a salesperson. But you fill out RFPs and you respond to sales requests and stuff like that. You're not like the guy calling people up like, oh, so I heard you're interested. And no. But you fill the RFPs and things like that. Right. So I think when I talk to customers about Drupal, you know, you're often comparing it against a proprietary CMS, especially when you get to a larger area of the market. At the low level, the like $10,000 projects, it's like Drupal or WordPress kind of thing. But if you're talking about $100,000 projects, it's usually Drupal versus SharePoint, Drupal versus Vignette, and that kind of thing. So one thing to talk about is like the life cycle. So like your typical enterprise website is going to last about 5 years. These numbers are completely made up, by the way. They're not from any study or anything like that. I just faked it. But I think it's pretty reflective of reality. So, like, the first year, you know, a proprietary CMS, you know, is, like, primarily license fee, right? You get Vignette or SharePoint, you pay through the nose. You pay for every seat, which is totally stupid there in the land of the Internet. Like, who cares how many seats you have? But you pay for every seat of every person who's editing the software. And there's a huge, you know, $50,000, $2 million, $5 million. I mean, like, Oracle's CMS solutions cost in the millions. License fees. You don't get anything for that. All you get is the software, which you get for Drupal for free. You know, and then over time, over the course, you know, so contrast that with Drupal, where you don't pay anything for the license. But, you know, you'd be lying if you told customers that, like, you'll just plug in Drupal and it'll work for you, right? It's not like that. It's expensive, complex sites usually. Huge, you know, they require budgets, they require development expertise, and it is a large consulting cost up front, which a lot of proprietary CMSs don't. They just plug in and they work in some cases. Then over time, though, you see like a proprietary CMS, you'll notice that the development and support costs, they keep going up. And when you try to migrate off of it, well, forget about it. The data's locked in, so that's extremely expensive, usually. But the costs keep trending up. And why do they trend up? Because as you customize a proprietary product, you have less and less control over it. You have to maintain more and more code, essentially, right? It becomes your customizations. And you're also usually locked into a few vendors. There's only so many certified Fatwire people or certified Vignette people or whatever. Contrast that with Drupal, your support and development costs tend to go down over the course of your life cycle, your website. Why? Because you're contributing your code back. You're using other people's existing solutions, and you're having to do less and less maintenance. You have less custom code as you go on. You know, and that's, I think, the idea of total cost of ownership. And then the migration, of course, is a big concern as well. And it's extremely cheap with Drupal or any open system because, well, the data's right there. You can access it. The code's right there. You're not limited by someone else's decision of what you can access. And that's all about total cost of ownership, which is really the basis of why open source solutions win in the marketplace. And, you know, but I think that one thing that we miss out on when we talk about it, I think a lot of people talk to clients and they say, oh, well, you don't have to pay a license fee. And you'll never have to pay a license fee. You know, and that's not really a good enough argument in an enterprise situation because people know what open source is and they know that doesn't mean it's free. But I think that what's important to communicate is that unless you contribute your code back, you don't really actualize these benefits. So, do anyone have any idea why you wouldn't actually get the benefits? Other people working on your code, if you contribute it back, they work on your code, they improve it, they keep it secure, and so it lowers your costs going forward, right? As opposed to you maintain it yourself. Also, what happens if you hack code? What happens if you need a feature in organic groups and you change organic groups and you don't contribute it back? Has anyone done that before? Yes, the next upgrade you lose your changes, or it's a pain to merge them in, or you are no longer getting security checks by a security team. So, and in that case, if you don't actually contribute back, then you're not really any better than the proprietary solution, other than the license cost, because you're still maintaining more and more custom code going forward, and that sucks. The other thing I tried to, you know, I think I did this naively at the beginning. I thought that customers would care about Drupal and this cool community, and the fact that we get together twice a year and go party and, you know, have fun, and we all are like, you know, this sort of commune on the internet, and you know, we hug each other and fight and everything, but they really don't care about that stuff at all. So I typically don't talk about that. Again, like, don't talk with the altruistic standpoint of it. I just talk about it strategically, that like, if you become part of this community and give back, you get the benefits of everything that your competitors and other companies or whatever are all doing, and you get so much more. And you know, it's not just about license cost savings, right? They care about the bottom line, but it's really not about just saving money on license costs. And I think that a lot of times in sales processes, we focus too much on that. We don't focus on the long-term viability of the software. This is my friend Kelly Albrecht I talked to. He's the founder of LeftClick, which is a great web dev shop in Western Massachusetts. Excuse me. He says, in open source, you get a lot for free. Updates, new features, bug fixes. Contributing our features and fixes ensures that the client's site will receive all of these open source software benefits into the future. I think that's kind of key, but a big piece of that is also, like, how many of you work for clients? Like, you work at an agency? Only a couple of you? So all of you work in organizations? None of you are consultants? No, that's kind of surprising. A few of you are consultants, but so when you're a consultant, one thing that you have to do is, I think a lot of people, what I'm talking about makes sense to them, but then they say, well, I have this deadline, so I can't just, like, go write a big patch for this module because the client doesn't care, and then I won't be able to deliver my deadline on time, so they don't do it. And part of that is difficult to sell to clients. It's like, why should I spend extra money now to make sure your code goes into the main module? Because it doesn't benefit me, right, the client right now. It benefits them a few years down the road. But I think there's a lot of benefits. So sometimes what we do is we discount. So we say, hey, so the client does have this budget, and we're going to eat some of the profits basically to make sure we contribute it back because it actually benefits us too. So sometimes that's something that we would do. Another big factor is the bus factor. So bus factor is, what if a guy gets hit by a bus? So if the code's on Drupal.org, your developer can get hit by a bus or a train or any other fast-moving object, and, like, you know, you can find someone else to work on it perhaps, and it's not like, you know, that, you know, it's not like she wrote all this code, and then like she's gone, and now we can't get it done. So, and you know, but I think a lot of shops naively they're worried about that. They think like, well, if I contribute all the code back, then the customer can just walk and they can go to any shop they want to get the job done. And so they want that maintenance contract, that retainer, that like custom code. You know, and I think that the key is like, you know, yes, when you contribute, your customers can leave you more easily, but if you're good, then they won't anyway. So I wouldn't, if your basis of income is based on that assumption, then good luck to you anyway, I would say. So management. So not that kind of manager. Helping people reach their full potential. And how do you do that? Is anyone here a manager? Have like people to report to them? A few of you? You know, a lot of Drupal shops, this can be difficult because, you know, people want programmers, despite the stereotypes, are very creative. It's a creative profession. It's not like there's an instruction manual. It's, you know, it's like you just have to figure out solutions to problems all the time. And so creative people will do the work you need them to do to a certain extent, but you also need to give them freedom to do what they want to do that's intriguing to them. And so a lot of different companies have different ways of doing that. At Acquia, for instance, like we structure it so that all the engineering team, they get 2 days every 3 weeks of free Drupal time. It's called gardening days, and you can tend your gardens, your modules, or whatever you want. You have to report back, tell people what you did, but there's not a lot of limitations on what it is. You can kind of do anything that's Drupal-related. And then, you know, a lot of the jobs, like if you're working in Drupal Gardens, for instance, most of the work we do is contributed anyway. So if we're improving modules on Drupal Gardens, 99% of that's going back to the community regardless. So we get a lot of time to contribute back as developers, which is really great. And that 2 days every 3 weeks gets pinched all the time. So it's totally a lie as well. Like every company has these goals. They don't really happen. Has anyone here heard of like Google's 20% rule? Yeah, a couple of you, which is that Google employees get 20% of their time to work on something. It doesn't happen. I have friends that work at Google. It never happens. But there are certain people who have taken that time, and groups have put in proposals to get more time, and that's why we have things like Google Maps and Google News and like a lot of mostly good stuff, actually, came out of the 20% time. Palantir is a big Drupal shop in Chicago. I talked to Colleen Carroll, who's their director of people in process, whatever that means, and a friend. So they only get 2 to 4 hours a week. But they have these special projects that get treated like clients. So, for instance, they work on something called Workbench. Has anyone heard of that? It's very cool. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out. Workbench. It's like a different set of interfaces for managing content, really targeted towards the person who's editing the content, not a programmer who's administering the system, but like their workflow, finding things they need to edit. And so that gets treated like a real client, has a budget, has a team, and they like set aside time to work on it, which is cool. She said, when I talked to this, any time you set aside self-enrichment time for your team, you're not only boosting morale, but you're helping open opportunities for your team to deepen their skill set. And I think that's really key, because you end up like working for clients all the time, and you just redo the same things and the same boring old ways of doing it, and then you don't actually get smarter. You just get better at doing the dumb thing you did before. But when you get free time to explore, you tend to pick up new skills, which can open up new opportunities. And so, you know, that's like really key to like the also like the Drupal companies that people want to work for, the Lullabots, Acquia, Palantir, whatever, Coinbit. Like these are companies which encourage a lot of participation. So developers, it's not just about the money. They want to go somewhere where they can have their creative, you know, thing there, whatever. They can get that nurturing. I'm not going to talk about this one, but I did like this quote from Greg Knudsen. You guys know Greggles? Yeah, he works. He's like head of the security team, and he's with Growing Venture Solutions, which is now part of Acquia. But he said, for the past 3 years, over 60% of our revenue comes from community efforts or referrals from other companies. If we didn't contribute, we wouldn't get that. And that's really key, too. It's not like as a manager, you're like, oh, I'm giving away time. It's non-billable for people to work on whatever they want. Right? But someone like Greggles, he sees the benefit in that they just get tons of business from that. So when you're developers, you just like give them time to hack on a module, hack on it, do whatever. And all of a sudden, they've written the next views or the next rules or something like that. And then you just get tons of work as the expert of that. They go to conferences. They speak about the modules they built. That brings in clients, right? They have clients who have specific problems there. They contact them. It turns into a big deal. You know, so all of that also drives business by letting people explore on their own. And then, you know, a big thing also is hiring. So how many of you hire Drupal developers? Any of you? Just like a couple of you? So what do you look for? When you look into a resume or someone applies, Mm-hmm. Why? Sure. Why don't you look at their resume or their... Look at it, but, you know, they can say anything they want in their resume. Right? You know, and there's, you know, the hiring is really important in the community. It's a good way to judge ability, like you said. But also, you know, the connections on Drupal.org are how the majority of the quote-unquote big shots got their chance. I wouldn't say I'm a big shot. Maybe I'm a medium shot now in Drupal. But I was once a very small shot. And, you know, it's through my relationship with Jacob because of the name conflict, right, which is awesome. And Robert Douglas, who I got to know pretty well. You know, and other people that I met along the road. Jose Deiro, who's like IE10 guru, whatever. He's a good friend, early friend of mine, the DevSeed guys. Meeting them, just hanging out, asking them questions, coming to their modules, and those connections are what has really propelled me in terms of my career growth with Drupal, and, excuse me, and being involved in that. And so I think, you know, as a manager, you know, and I have managed teams and I have done hiring, I don't only look at what they've done on the D.O page, because some people don't commit code very much up there, but if I can ask somebody I know about them, well, that's if they vouch for them, then it's golden. You know, I'll hire them. I won't even have to ask any more questions usually. So, you know, call it nepotism or whatever, but anyone can get involved and learn, and I think that's okay. This is Evan, really great guy. He's the co-founder of SubHub. You guys heard of SubHub? Yeah, it's like Drupal Gardens. It's like a hosted Drupal service. It's sort of a competitor. He said, you know, it's a major differentiator for a candidate. You know, first, it shows they understand Drupal. Second, it shows they are motivated to do more than just show up and punch the clock. So it's a character issue as well as a skills issue. I think that was really interesting you said that. It's not just that we know that, oh, this person knows module development well, right? Because if they've been committing to Drupal.org and going out of their way to be part of the community and being involved, it shows that they care about that, right? That's they have a drive to do something for everyone, to give back their code, to be peer-reviewed. They're not afraid of that. And that's like a character issue for him, which makes it a valuable place to hire from.
Developers.
So, as a developer, you know, how is contributing strategic? Why should you contribute as a developer? Because there's, I don't know how many of us there were. This is some crazy math. I'm just going to make up some more numbers, but they're pretty accurate. We had a discussion recently on the Acquia mailing list, but you know, there's been a lot of controversy that Acquia is like sucking up all the core contributors, right? And all these posts have been going around. So we were talking about that, and it was like, if you look at it, of the top 100 contributors to Drupal Core, there's like I think 10% of them are Acquians, right? And what's even more crazy is I'm on that list, and I don't even really work in Core all that much. So like the actual number of developers who actually contribute heavily to Core is only like 20 people, I would say. And then there's like another like 50 of us who are tangentially involved or something like that. And then there's a long tail of people who are involved in like one or two issues. That's how Drupal Core is built. And, you know, so out of this massive community of developers, there's really only few who are major contributors. If you want to join that group, you can do so relatively quickly. It's not like you have to start from somewhere way down. You can actually get there really quickly. But I think a lot of the problem people have is they have full-time jobs. Like, I had this problem until I worked for Acquia. I couldn't contribute all that much because I had to deliver stuff for clients all the time, and that made it difficult to do so. So, you know, how do you contribute and still get the project in on time? That's what my friend Moshe said. I don't know if that's really the only answer. It must be more than that. But, you know, I think there's some more specific things. So one thing is coding with an intent to distribute. So when you – it's going to get a little nerdy here. I apologize. So when you hack a module and you're changing something, essentially what you're doing is you're breaking from the mothership, right? You're not receiving the main code from Drupal.org anymore. Now you have your own version of the module, essentially, or the theme or whatever you have. And you have to do that sometimes, but it's much better if you can avoid it. So that's why Drupal has this system of alters. How many people here are developers? Am I speaking to any programmers here? Yeah, okay. So quite a few of you. So, you know, Drupal is all about any code, any module, being able to affect the functionality of any other module anywhere it can, which is totally insane and impossible to debug. But that's sort of that's just the way it is. So, but the nice thing about it is that instead of having to, like, go into a module's code and modify it and then get disconnected from the upstream, You should be able to implement a hook alter function somewhere to change a form or to change the HTML output or to change some settings somewhere. You know, and there's other ways to do this, pre-process hooks. There's a lot of different ways that, but as a principle, as a guiding principle, if you're fairly new to Drupal and you're used to other systems, think, you know, hook alters all the time. Think about how can I write code which will affect the functionality of the thing I want to change without changing the code that's generating that element on the page or that functionality. So really look for ways to integrate your own changes outside of the modules without hacking it. But if you must hack, track. Right, so documenting patches and hacks. This is really crucial, especially if you're you're working on a product like Drupal Gardens. So we have to hack models all the time. Like we'll tell you, we'll get up here and lecture and say don't hack core, but we have like 40 hacks to core. And contributed modules, because it's just part of being early adopters and working on the earliest stuff and still making it usable for people. And so there's a lot of different ways that you can track the fact that you've modified it, because later when you go to update it, like you said before, you won't know, you won't be able to receive the updates because you don't know that you've modified the file. So you want to be able to make sure all the time that you know what you've changed. So if you need to update, then you can redo that hack. So one thing we do is keep a patches.txt file. So this is what a lot of people do. It's really lightweight. Basically, every time we change a module, we have a text file which sits in our repository, and it contains the date that we changed it, the initials of the person who changed it, and a link which points to a Drupal.org issue where we posted the patch. So we'll modify a module, for instance, like Path Auto or Comment Notify module, right, which emails people when comments have been posted. We wanted to make an improvement there, I think, to like use some Ajax to hide some piece of the page or something like that to make it more usable. And we thought that this would go into the module eventually. Made the patch, cut it, uploaded it to the Comment Notify queue, right? And Greg was like, I don't want to commit that. I don't think it's a good idea. I said, okay, we'll argue about this for a while, but right now our users want it. So take the patch as the text file, put in a link to that issue, the date, person, then we commit it, and then every couple weeks, every month, we go back to that list and review all of them and see if they've been updated and see if Greg has changed his mind or something has happened. And so that's what we do with patches.txt. Very, very lightweight, very low tech. Other people have suggested like they rename the module in the info file, so they call it like views modified or something like that. People put CVS in SVN sometimes. Has anyone done that before? Like you check your CVS repository into SVN, or you check your CVS checkout? No? You guys weren't there for the unholy hack days? And now I don't know how it works really, because you have Git and SVN, so how do you commit your changes to version control and still know what are the changes coming from Drupal.org? I don't think anyone's figured it out yet. But ultimately, it's really important to keep track of these things. And so even if you don't plan on contributing, it's really important to track it. And this is, I think, a lot of you may not be contributors yet, and so if you're not, and that's cool, I understand why you wouldn't be, but code with the intent that you may contribute everything eventually, and it will help you later on when you decide that you need to contribute something. I talked to Mikey Town, and he said, if there's no D.O issue, then the patch should not be in our repo. That's an interesting approach. So what he's saying is, like, if you're not posting the patch online for everyone, then you shouldn't be changing it on your own site for your client, right? And he's saying that keeps the spirit of the GPL going. So even if we know that the patch will never be accepted, even if it's something wild and crazy, at least we're giving our code to other people, so we're sharing our modifications with other people, and that maybe someone else wants the crazy thing that we want, and they find it, and then, I do highly recommend that. And then there's something called dog. Has anyone heard of dog? Yeah? And does it work? Yeah, right. I think that's what a lot of people say. That's by my friend Sam Boyer. I'm not sure if this actually works or not. What do you know about it? Have you tried it? Like, you haven't looked at it? Nothing? Getting Nager, yeah. This whole project is about what I'm talking about, basically, that you can hack modules for your client, and you can still track what are your local hacks and what are the updates coming from Drupal.org and merge them together. It's a difficult problem to solve, but there's this project called Dog, which is supposed to do it for you, and I don't know where it's at right now. So other than, like, yeah, that stuff, the technical stuff, a big thing for developers is also, you know, sort of this is what I call the guild of nerds. So you, when I started out, like I said, people were really unfriendly in IRC. Has anyone had that experience? Yeah? You've had that experience? Was it me? No? Okay. you might be told to RTFM. Do you know what that means? Yes? Or UTSL. You know what that means? Use the source, Luke. Yeah, that's a good one. You know, and so I think that can be difficult. And moving from one of those people who was annoying to somebody who was told to RTFM to being the other side of things, where people are bugging me on IRC, and I don't have time. Like, I'd love to help them. I'm not a jerk. Like, I actually don't do that. I think I'm pretty nice to people if they're new. I don't like, you know. But sometimes people will be really entitled, and they'll say, "Why aren't you fixing my problem? Or why is there a bug in the software?" Like I owe them something. And then I'll just ignore them. But there's a difference. Like, if Omar asks me something, I'll just respond every time. And, you know, even if he asks me a question that's, like, a little complicated, I'll actually take some time away from my project I'm doing right now, if I can, and I will, like, spend 5 minutes researching it for him. And I think he'd do the same. And probably anyone who I know in the community who I've had some interactions with, I've had some beers at DrupalCon, they've come to my sessions, I've come to theirs, and we've had this community, we've worked on each other's modules, you join that guild of nerds, and then it's different. You get a different treatment when you have to ask questions. And it's not, like, exclusive club, like anyone can join, you just have to start contributing some code and being involved. But it, I mean, would you say it makes a huge difference in terms of how you get your job done? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the primary thing, really. Because Drupal is really, I teach Drupal now, so I have a lot of experience, I think, in how people learn Drupal, and it's really, really hard to learn. And the reason it's really hard to learn, well, do anyone have any guesses why it's really hard to learn? Yeah. Yeah, giant collection of Lego blocks. What you're trying to build. Sure. So it doesn't... It's not, but it's not... Like, WordPress is targeted to be a blog, but Drupal has all the abstract terms that don't mean anything. Yeah. I think that's a key point. For me, the main thing is all a combination of what you all said, which is that it's like there's a lot of contextual knowledge, tribal knowledge. There's just like, it's not obvious. You just have to like have enough pain and enough whatever experience, and then you realize how something works. But it's very hard to just sort of explain something to. There's inconsistencies everywhere. Different APIs are built different ways, and so you can't just say this is a rule, follow it. It's more like explore, you get knowledge, and then you're good at it. And that's not very good. So given that, it helps to have, especially now that we're at the code base has reached a level of complexity and size, I don't know all of it anymore, right? No one does. Not even Dries or Angie do. That's scary. So you really need to have this guild of people you can call upon. If I have a problem with this module or this piece of functionality, I know the people that I can reach out to. I know they'll respond because I do the same thing for them. And so this is really what has made me successful as a Drupal developer. I like how Bim put it. He's someone who used to be on my team for Amnesty. Says you can lie on your resume, but you can't lie on your D.O profile. Also, contributing to Drupal helps build a reputation, both among fellow developers and among companies. This is sort of a key point that I'm driving in here, just about building legitimacy. You know, it's nice because I think it's in open source communities, it's actually really easy to establish yourself as an expert. It didn't feel that way when I wasn't, but now looking back, I think everyone. Actually, I did a little like survey with some people, and I sent out and. So what is the number one thing that you wish you had known before you started? And everybody, the first thing was, I wish I had started contributing sooner. That, like, I wish I didn't wait so long. I wish I didn't think that I wasn't good enough. I wish I didn't think that it wasn't worth it, because it's changed. It made it a much more pleasurable experience, and I've been much more successful. And, you know, and that contributing will drive consulting opportunities to you. It'll establish yourself in the community. And also, even if you're not a programmer, there's a lot you can contribute. I know that gets said a lot, and it's hard for people to... envision what those things are. One big thing, though, is just blogging. The documentation on Drupal.org is, it's I don't know if it's possible to fix it, honestly. Like, it's just, like, there's just too much stuff. It's not organized. And the best documentation is really blog posts, people saying, I just built this cool feature with these modules, and that's really useful, and I think it's okay to keep it on your own blog. People would contend with me that that's not a good idea, that it should be in one central place, but I think it's fine. So if you're a project manager or you're just someone with a nonprofit and you figure something out, just blog about it. Because the reality is, what you think is really simple, maybe really simple, and it may be so simple that nobody's thought to write an article about it. But like hundreds of people have struggled with it. Thousands of people have struggled with it. So I highly recommend that. Yeah, and again, like just to close with a couple people that I like. Jake Strawn, he's presenting tomorrow morning, I think, on the Omega theme. He's like one of the gurus of front-end development in Drupal. My contributions to the community and my expertise within those contributions now account for roughly 95% of the work I do. So he built a business by building this thing called Omega, which is this great responsive theming framework or whatever, and that just drives all of his business. He doesn't have to go out and find clients ever. They just come to him because he built this really cool thing. Jennifer Hogden's documentation lead, right? And she says that contributing to the Drupal project has increased my credibility as an expert-level Drupal professional, which I think or hope leads to more clients deciding to hire me rather than my competition. Right? And she's very credible, I feel like as a developer, it's really important that you contribute, because that's really, like I said, in other systems, it's not as important maybe. But in Drupal, that's how you get things done. You build that guild of nerds. You build your credibility. That's what gets you a job. So it gets you more money. So it gets you all the connections. And so it's really crucial that you do it, even if it's uncomfortable at first. So just to close, then we can maybe have a discussion and open it up a little bit. All right. So contributing, why is it strategic? Long-term value for customers is not a short-term win. It's not cheaper in the short term. But by contributing those changes back, you're building long-term value for them. It provides innovation in companies. So by encouraging a culture of contributing and creativity, you build new revenue streams, you make great new things, you have happier employees, you have people who want to work for you. And as a developer, contributing gives you legitimacy, and it builds a community for you, which makes it a much better place to work. And it's definitely changed my life. And so the number one thing, again, from everyone is, do it now. Don't wait. Don't say that, maybe some other day I'm not really into this Drupal thing. Even if you're just a little bit into this Drupal thing, start contributing. Start blogging about what you're working on, and it will change how you interact with the software in a huge way. So, and that's it. Thanks. And, yeah, anyone want to, any questions or things you want to discuss? Yeah. Sure. You think, like, if... What do you guys think? Anyone else? Any other programmers? Yeah. Yeah. From Drush. Yeah. I mean, that would help some, but I think what you're getting at is a different topic also. So there's two things. One is, like, when you post a patch right now, a patch file, for those who don't know, is basically, it's a text file that describes the difference between the way the code was and the way that you want it to be. And you can give that to your friends, and then they can apply it to their local code and change the code. So right now, the way it works is you have to go, you run a command to take the patch, the text file, you go to drupal.org, you say create new issue, bug, fill up the description, and then you upload the patch, and then someone else has to review it, and then other people upload other patches, and it ends up with like 20 patches and like a forum-based thing, and it's very hard to kind of read what the difference is between them, and it's not, the best tool. So one thing is mentioned is that there's tools like Dog, which make it so that you don't have to go through the process of going through the web form and doing all that, which helps a bit. It definitely helps your workflow not feel distracted and have to do that. But then you're making another point, which is more like a lot of modern systems like GitHub have things like pull requests, right, which is that instead of doing it that way, what I say is, okay, Jacob, I want to make some changes to your module. Let me take a copy of your module, make my changes, and then say, hey, do you want these changes? And then I just have to press a button saying, yes, I want those changes. And it's a little simpler, and it has other benefits. I think the answer is yes. It's just like someone's just got to do it. I don't think anyone would really disagree that that's a better way to do things. I'm sure, well, it's Drupal. Somebody would. Like, a few hundred people probably would. But I don't think it'd be a massive opposition. Yeah. Right. That's a really crucial point. A lot of people feel like they need to contribute a module, have some idea, like it's a startup or something like that. It's not. The best of everyone who's good at this get started patching other people's modules first. You don't just write your own usually. Yeah. It means you're not really looking around at what's available. Yeah. Anything else? What do people in institutions do in terms of contribution? Does anyone here work for McGill? You work for McGill, but how do you guys do any contributions back to the community? Do you plan to? Do you have ideas on how you might do it? Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, you also, with that many sites, I'd be really afraid of having any custom code. Every line of custom code is going to cost you many thousands of dollars, basically, in the course of the maintenance of all those sites. I mean, keeping deploying custom things and maintaining them with all these different things is probably... Oh, someone else found it and posted patches. Awesome, isn't it? Yeah. My first module was one called Admin Role. Did you hear that one? Yeah, we used Drupal 6, Admin Role. Now it's in 7. But that was like the simplest. I was like, no one's ever. I was embarrassed. I wouldn't post it, and then someone's made me do it in Civic Actions. And okay, no one's really going to want this. It's like only 50 lines long. All it does is make it so you have more than one administrator on your site. Drupal 6, you really only have one. And it's like, I don't know, 40,000 sites or. Sites use it now or something. I mean, I was like, patches, everyone started using it. I was like, well, wow, that's amazing. it was such a cool feeling, this code I wrote for Fetchy Solar is running on the White House website. Oh my god, how'd that happen? Anyway, yeah, right. Yes, it's my fault. The US is my fault. Entirely. Everything's wrong with America is my fault. But yeah. Oh, God, yeah. It's a thing that it's code. All right, we're already at your floor. Let's see. There's Drupal. Just army knife. I think it depends who you're talking to. I'll throw depends out there. But when I'm consulting with, like, large organizations who don't... their angle is that they don't want to maintain lots of different systems. So... if I'm consulting with an enterprise who has, they have a blogging platform, an e-commerce platform, and they have a community management platform, and then they have, like, some marketing site platform, and they have all these different things, and they're all by, like, vendors who built things specifically for those areas, and they pay license costs, they manage all these vendors and all these consultants, and Drupal for them is, like, an operating system, sort of, for all of their web properties, because they can flexible enough to do all of those things, so they can build in-house capacity and work with, like, a few vendors to get stuff done. And they can build it out for most of their systems. Obviously not their accounting and their ERP and stuff like that, but it's for anything that's like a public-facing website or an intranet, they can probably do it in Drupal. And it may not be the perfect tool for that task, but it's better that they don't have to have 50 tools to manage. So think of like an operating system for their web properties. If you're talking to like clients who are maybe smaller, who it's like, I don't know what's a good example, but maybe like, a business that like does warehousing and shipping or something boring like that, and they have a few hundred employees or something like that, and they just need like a website to show about their company and some place like have a couple forms to enter in, like contact us type stuff, and maybe they have some kind of interactive see your shipments page or something like that, one custom module. And for them, I would say that You know, Drupal has a wide community of developers, so that you're not locked in. Like, this software will continue to live. And you'll be able to find other developers to work on this in the future. It's easy to hire people as you grow, and it's flexible as of your needs, and you're not locked into a vendor. Because I think a lot of those people are really afraid of lock-in, because they've been burned before. When they're like, they're not a software company, they don't understand software, and they don't want to get into a situation where they have a vendor who's just like taking them to the cleaners, and they don't have any way to get out of it. So, yeah. 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 Yeah, that's a good question. I guess, does anyone else have any answers? I've been doing all the talking up here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that for the marketing people, the key thing, and they can be a difficult bunch, but the really key thing is marketing people are always, they hate their IT departments. They're just like frustrated to death that they cannot put this thing out that they want to put out now, and they have to wait forever for it to go through some process, and there's all these bugs and priorities and all this crap. They hate that. And so they're the ones that usually bring in rogue software, like they'll just like buy something and install it, or they'll like go use Facebook or whatever, that kind of thing to get their job done. And so if you talk about Drupal has 7,000 add-on modules, you know, add-on modules. You can just add them yourself, and it's kind of a lie, but it's sort of true. And it means that they can get new features really quickly, and that's appealing to them. They don't have to wait for their development team to build the features, because a lot of these companies are used to the IT team building every single feature that they get or buying some new piece of software. And so that idea of, like, there's this app store or whatever you can choose from, they like that. They love their iPhone, so app store is a good word. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, that helps a lot. I mean, now it's a lot easier than it used to be, because it's not like you have to prove that Drupal is a viable solution. Really, it's not really the question. It's more like, is it a fit for you? But, you know, to be honest, there's a really good email thread at Acquia. Somebody sent around this great video, like short video explaining what salespeople do, and it was nice. And there was a discussion with like salespeople and engineers going on, and one of the sales directors, he said, you know, the key thing is that your clients, they don't care about Drupal. What they care about is actually the vendor. So like, especially in the enterprise, it's like, when we go in, we're selling Acquia. We're not really selling Drupal. Like, we talk about Drupal and we use it as a selling point. It's certainly part of the sales process. But they're more concerned, like, is this vendor going to be around? Are they going to pick up my website when it goes down? Are they going to be reliable? Are they just BSing me, or are they really going to deliver? So I think that a lot of clients, sadly, they should be really excited about all the advantages they get, but it's more about building a relationship with the vendor, I think. But establishing yourself as an expert in Drupal and showing them that you are does help the process a lot, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But they don't want to pick a vendor who's like, you know, a sideline type thing. You say that, you know, yeah, we built the White House website, we built Amnesty, it, you know, goes a long way. So that was a really long elevator ride, but, yeah. Next time I'm in the Sears Tower talking to your marketing people, then, like, that'd be good. Yeah. Well, I think it's 2:50, I don't know. Should we head out, or is it? Are we ready? Oh, yes. Miss Brent. Which one is it? Right, so it starts at 3:15. This is CSS3 Spectacular. Don't know French. Estimating Drupal projects. starts in 20 minutes from now. Yeah, thank you.